This is Ken Stringfellow of the Posies, Big Star, etc., and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. Today around 9:30, we will speak live with Will Solomon, a reporter for the River Newsroom, who has spent the last couple of months of 2020 reporting on the Columbia County-based group Do We Need This? They're an anti-vaccination group, and he'll tell his story around 9:30. We'll also hear the public news service headlines and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. And it all begins after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
In air waves controlled. On air, in air channel connection. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network.
This is the news.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Fridman Gallery in New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about anything you hear here. Ted Remsnyder is reporting for Columbia Green Media that Greene County officials will spend $1.6 million in federal funding to extend natural gas service to the Catskill Exit 21 West Medical Campus project. At the meeting of the Greene County Legislature Public Works Committee on January 10th, the committee unanimously approved a resolution to enter into an agreement with the Central Hudson Gas and Electric Company to extend the natural gas infrastructure to the site. The measure now goes to the full legislature for a vote. The county will receive just under $9.2 million in federal funding from the American Rescue Plan Act, as approved in March. Columbia Memorial Hospital, Albany Medical Center, and the New York Oncology Hematology intend to construct a 40,000-square-foot medical facility on a 60-acre site in Catskill off Exit 21 from the New York State Thruway, owned by the Greene County Industrial Development Agency. The facility will focus on outpatient treatment. The private sector developers will build their facility first before the county constructs its planned mental health and community services facility at the same site. Quote, "What we're trying to do is create a medical campus," unquote, Greene County Administrator Sean Groden said. Quote, "We'll have the two anchors there, and we have the possibility of what we call two more pads where people, we can entice a cataract or ophthalmology type center so that three or four of them can complement each other versus competing with each other," unquote. Groden said the medical groups could begin construction as soon as the weather breaks in the spring. He hopes to start construction of the mental health center by the end of 2023. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com.
Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that with the state's eviction moratorium set to expire January 15th, New York State officials on January 11th began accepting applications for the Emergency Rental Assistance Program. The eviction moratorium was put into place because of the COVID-19 pandemic, which is now worse than ever. New York extended the moratorium once last summer as the federal eviction moratorium ended. On January 11th, Governor Kathy Hochul said she was discussing with lawmakers the future of the eviction moratorium. New York officials previously asked the federal government for an additional $1 billion for the assistance program and say they need that extra money. The Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance said, and I quote, "Reopening the application portal without additional fundings to support the backlog of existing and future applications runs the risk of giving New Yorkers false hope for critical financial relief that, without federal intervention, simply does not exist," end quote. It added, and I quote, "Our appeal to the Treasury represents the latest in our continued and vigorous advocacy for tenants and landlords still reeling from the financial impact of the pandemic," end quote.
Andrea Macko reports for Porcupine Soup that on January 12th, the Cairo Town Board for the second time voted on two positions on the town's planning board. Before last year ended, outgoing Cairo Town Supervisor John Coyne and the former town board voted to reappoint Planning Board Chair Joseph Hasenkopf and alternate member Christopher Keff. But their seats were not open for appointments until the end of the year, when Coyne was no longer supervisor and the town board changed. As the first vote was taken, two of the town board members, Jason Watts and Mary Jo Cords, abstained, explaining that the old board was not allowed to vote on appointments that were up to the future board. Soon after the vote, town attorney Tal Rapplier said the first vote was illegal. Quote, "Because the seats weren't vacant at the time of the appointment, there is no appointment because there was no seat to be filled," unquote, Rapplier said. Quote, "The only exception would have been if the entire town board were going to be the same from last year to this year, then they could make that motion then because you basically wouldn't be tying the hands of a future board," unquote, he continued. Quote, "So since we had some change in the board and there were no vacancies in the seats until January 1st, we have to go back and redo it," unquote. On January 12th, the new board voted to keep Hasenkopf as planning board chair, but chose Richard Lorenz as alternate instead of Keff. Watts, Cords, and new board member Michael Flaherty voted for Lorenz, with Stephen Kralovich and Tim Powers favoring Keff. Lorenz was previously on the town board and a member of the planning board, which he resigned from in April of 2016. Read more about this story in Porcupine Soup.
Andrea Mako reports for Porcupine Soup that, for the 10th time, the federal trial of former Prattsville Town Supervisor Corey O'Hara and local businessman Stephen Baker has been delayed. The two are charged with alleged fraud relating to grants Prattsville got after Hurricane Irene wrecked the town in western Greene County. On December 29th, United States District Judge Frederick J. Scullin signed a 10th 90-day continuance, moving the trial date to April 4th. Lawyers for the defendants asked for the delay to, and I quote, "engage in plea negotiations, file motions, and prepare for trial," end quote. Hara and Baker were indicted in November 2019 for conspiracy to commit wire fraud, and theft concerning a program receiving federal funds. In addition, O'Hara is charged with bank fraud,
and making false statements on a loan application. According to the documents, and I quote, the government has produced over 640,000 pages of discovery, including financial records for a number of bank accounts, grant applications, and related documents, search warrants executed on a business and an email account, and items seized pursuant to those warrants, end quote. Read more about this story at Porcupine Soup.
Nick Reisman is reporting for New York State of Politics that the New York State Department of Motor Vehicles will expand the availability of road tests for anyone looking to get their commercial driver's licenses as a way to address a shortage of truck and bus drivers. Motor vehicle officials will hold a public hearing on January 26th to address the question of how to create more capacity for state-run sites and road tests by allowing qualified third parties to offer them. Governor Kathy Hochul said, quote, by enabling third parties to give the road test for truck and bus drivers, we will create new avenues for New Yorkers to begin exciting careers, for our children to get school to school, and to ensure that vital goods get to where they need to be, unquote. The move comes as truck driver shortages have created supply chain troubles nationwide, while in some cases a shortage of school bus drivers have forced school districts to turn to remote learning. Republican State Senator Mike Martucci, the former owner and operator of a school bus company, applauded the move to turn to third-party entities to provide the tests. Martucci said, quote, I am excited Governor Hochul has taken up this important cause by directing the Department of Motor Vehicles to initiate a regulatory proceeding that will make third-party testing a reality in New York, unquote. Read more about this story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com.
Brendan J. Lyons reports for the Times Union that while state legislators can telecommute to work the worst part of the COVID-19 pandemic, Governor Kathy Hochul is insisting state employees report to their offices every day. The Public Employees Federation, the state's largest public labor union, does not agree with Hochul on this issue. PEF President Wayne Spence said in a statement issued January 11th, and I quote, by the state's own reports, this is the worst spread of infection we have seen at any time during this pandemic, and health experts predict this surge has not peaked yet. Rather than allow its workforce to protect themselves, their families, and the public from this surge by telecommuting as they did during previous surges, the state ignores this simple and effective strategy and, instead, chooses to broaden vaccine mandates, requires workers to wear masks all day at their desk, wastes its limited supply of COVID tests, and now forces another dose of vaccine upon its strained workforce. End quote. But while Hochul wants all state employees working normally, not all state employees are back in the office. The state comptroller's office, for instance, gave employees until January 12th to decide whether they need to continue telecommuting through January 24th. The attorney general's office in New York City is relying heavily on telecommuting, while their regional offices, including in Albany, are generally at below 50% of the workforce in the office. Other offices have less than perfect attendance, as employees who catch coronavirus call in sick. New York's largest union, the Civil Service Employees Association, is not complaining. Mark Kotzen, a CSEA spokesman, said, and I quote, as I've stated previously, the majority of the CSEA-represented state workforce has been working at their workplaces since before the start of the pandemic and continue to report to their places of employment. We have no further comment on this at the present time. End quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
And Natasha Von Holdridge is reporting for Columbia Green Media that the Chatham Board of Education is now looking to fill a vacant seat. Board of Education member Craig Simmons resigned last month as he was about to be sworn in as Gentz's new town supervisor. That resignation was made effective December 31st. Quote, we have had some people proactively reach out, but we don't have the timeline exactly worked out yet, unquote, Board of Education President Matthew Fish said. Quote, we haven't posted our request for interest. That's going to be happening in the next week or two. That will set the timeline and will also initiate, we hope, some extra interest. We take those letters of interest, we do some interviews and some basic evaluations, and we get someone in that seat as soon as we can, unquote. Under the law, the seat can be filled immediately by board appointment, or the board can call a special election. Quote, based on their feedback, I don't think anyone in the community has the appetite for a special election on a board seat. This is a pretty routine matter, unquote, Fish said. He said the board will find a new member and have them sworn in within 90 days. That person will serve through the May 2022 board election and have the option to run for the position to serve longer. He said, quote, board service is just the way that I have chosen to help our community. If anyone is looking to perform their civic duty, we could sure use the help, unquote. Read more about the story at HudsonValley360.com.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day. Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Thursday, a slight chance of snow between 9 and 11 a.m. Otherwise, it will be mostly cloudy with a temperature high near 39 degrees. Thursday night, a slight chance of snow after 4 a.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 24 degrees. And on Friday, partly sunny with a high near 28 degrees. And on Friday night, mostly clear, with a temperature low of around 0 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
You have tuned into all sorts of creative community voices on the radio today at WGXC 90.7 FM on Thursday, January 13th, including at 11 a.m., the Transformational Listening Show features Don Cherry's Cultural Explorations today. Then at noon, it's time for Ear Candy from Brad Munkle in Greenville, in Greene County. He features Amy Bellamy and Aaron Bellamy today, keyboardist and bassist from the ABs on his show, until 2 p.m., when it's time for Voting Rights Week on What's the Frequency Kenneth, the show that sets the week's news to brand new music. At 3 p.m. on Turn On the News, the coup continues again this week. At 3 p.m., Stefano De Ponte is the featured artist on the Radia show. At 7 p.m., we go live to Philmont and Heath Iverson and the Philmont Media Project for Movies on the Radio. Then at 9 p.m., we're live from Toronto with Andrew O'Connor and his pirate radio show Disco 3000. And at 10 p.m., we're live from Columbia County with The Magic Stranger on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
To get a local event mentioned on All Together Now, go to WGXC.org and click on Add an Event at the top of the page, and copy and paste the information about your event in the boxes. Let's all get involved in our community. See what's going on at WGXC.org in the community calendar.
Monday, January 17th, the citizens of Hudson are celebrating Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday with a holiday observance that begins at 11 a.m. with a motorcade preceding the rally. Vehicles line up at 10:30 a.m. at the Columbia and North 6th Street parking lot in Hudson. At the conclusion of the motorcade, there will be a short presentation on the steps of the Shiloh Baptist Church at 14 Warren Street in Hudson, and there will be special guest speakers and more. That is Monday, January 17th, from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., Martin Luther King Day in Hudson.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, January 13th. Hey, that is my little kitty that you just heard, so we're going to ignore that for now. And if you guys are as bored with the weather as I have been, well, that's going to change. Early this morning, temperatures are a little warmer than the last couple days. 24 degrees in New Baltimore and 27 in Chichester. A little warm-up is on the way, and so is some snow. Fairly organized flakes fall this morning, while the chance of squalls remain through the day. A high temperature of 42 is expected at 3 p.m. Overnight, it looks dry with a steady low of 30 degrees from 9 p.m. all the way to 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Friday will be dry with a high of only 31 at noon. Then temperatures start to fall, and fall they will. Taps will be dripping overnight as temperatures drop to 2 degrees, possibly considerably lower depending on your latitude and elevation, even in just our Twin County area. Saturday morning, conditions will be dangerously sub-freezing. Just don't go outside. If for some crazy reason you decide that it's absolutely necessary, you better look like the little brother from A Christmas Story, because the conditions will be dangerously sub-freezing, with potential frostbite in less than 14 minutes for exposed skin. During the day, a whopping high of 13 is expected at 3 p.m. Winds will still be up, so conditions will be freezing in the afternoon. If you layer up and protect any exposed skin, you have over an hour before frostbite becomes an issue, and it will be the most comfortable, in quotes, part of the day. 1 degree overnight takes us into a dry-looking Sunday with a more normal high of 23 degrees. It's quite possible this is the coldest couple of days we will get this winter. On Monday, it looks like a few inches of snow, then an afternoon melt, then some rain, and very dangerous overnight freeze. Stay tuned. Today's tide schedule, if it's relevant to you, is low tide at 5:48 a.m., then high tide at 11:55 a.m., low tide again at 6:39 p.m. Today's river temperature will be, you guessed it, 32 degrees. Sunset today will be at 4:31 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:17 a.m. Looking way up, we see geomagnetic activity is expected on Sunday as we enter a stream of solar plasma. Solar wind speed is currently 455 kilometers per second at 4.5 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently holding a steady pattern with fair conditions below 4 MHz till dark, then fair below 30 MHz overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 1. Quiet. The current sunspot number is 68. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Arthur and Karen of Hoover, Alabama. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're calling on the Senate to have that debate because we want to pass the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. We want to pass the Freedom to Vote Act. We know how much we have fought for.
Chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, Joyce Beatty, called on the Senate Wednesday to pass a pair of voting rights bills. President Joe Biden meets with Senate Democrats today as pressure grows to drop the filibuster, requiring 60 votes to advance legislation. The president spoke in Georgia this week in favor of allowing a simple majority vote on the measures, but currently Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and all 50 GOP senators oppose changing the rules. Republican South Dakota Senator John Thune.
I urge all of my Democrat colleagues to resist this blatant power grab by the Democrat leadership and preserve our long-standing commitment to representation for the minority in the United States Senate.
Amid growing inflation, Chief White House Economic Advisor Brian Deese said Wednesday the U.S. is well positioned to tackle economic challenges head on and added the president has a plan.
his approach to attacking prices and costs are grounded in the premise that the right way to do this is to build on the economic successes that we have seen, not to abandon them.
According to the Labor Department, consumer prices climbed 7% in 2021, the highest increase since 1982, which may be creating a drag on the president's job approval ratings. Just one-third of Americans approve of the job President Biden is doing, a new low, in a Quinnipiac University poll released Wednesday, a slight dip from November's rating of 36%. Another pressure on the president's popularity is the latest coronavirus surge. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Jeff Zients said Wednesday the Biden administration will send free rapid tests to schools each month in an effort to keep them open.
These 10 million additional tests available each month will allow schools to double the volume of testing they were performing in November.
Health officials now believe the Omicron variant will likely infect nearly everyone, regardless of vaccination status, but most people will weather it. Finally, a Guttmacher Institute report finds more than 100 abortion restrictions were enacted in 19 states last year, the most since abortion rights were affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973. The report also found some states expanded access to pregnancy and postpartum care and access to over-the-counter contraceptives. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And I'm Tom Rowe, live in Accra with the WGXC Morning Show. In just a few minutes, we're going to speak with Will Solomon, local journalist who spent time with the Columbia County-based group called Do We Need This? They're an anti-vaccine group. So we'll talk with him in just a second. Stay tuned. Right, you're listening to the WGXC Morning Show, and that's a little Spring Hill Jack to get us started. We'll bring that down now, and now with us on the phone is Will Solomon. He is the author of a story in the River Newsroom this week, tracking a group that I believe is based in Columbia County called Do We Need This? And they were a anti-vaccine group before it was all the rage. Is that true, Will?
that's somewhat true. I would sort of describe them as kind of a loose coalition. They kind of are not really a formal group, but they seem to sort of cohere around summer of 2020. Around some rallies in Albany that were protesting COVID-related executive orders in New York.
And what? Give us a little bit about your background and how did you get interested in this story?
Yeah, I've written in a freelance capacity for The River for about a year. I've just sort of been interested in. Just the intense divide around issues of vaccines and COVID mitigation measures ever since the pandemic started. I got interested in this group because maybe as some of your listeners know, they have at least one pretty prominent billboard up in Albany. I can't remember if it's on I-90 or 787, and it's basically opposing vaccine mandates. I don't remember exactly what it says, but I was kind of interested in the group, and I started looking into them, and I ended up talking to a bunch of people in kind of Columbia County and surrounding area about them and this sort of vaccine divide.
And I believe they're sort of the most prominent group in the area. I mean, we haven't really had a lot of like crazy school board mask arguments or demonstrations outside of health departments here that some other places in the country have. Is that true or not?
They definitely seem to be the most organized kind of group. I think one of the things we sort of tried to look at, but you know, honestly, it's kind of unclear, is the extent to which this anti-vax, you know, anti-mitigation sentiment exists independently from this group, and you know what kind of potential for growth that has. But yeah, they definitely seem to be the most organized kind of anti-vax group in this part of the Hudson Valley. Although there's definitely, you know, there's a big one they're sort of connected to in Western Mass. There's, you know, and there's plenty all over the Northeast, kind of a varying size.
And are they how evangelical are they? Are they really trying to convert people, or are they just trying to get out a message, what's your sense?
I would say it's more the latter. I think that there's definitely a recognition now that people are pretty entrenched in their camps. And this came up too. I know you spoke to Michael Richardson, who's a local activist, yesterday, and he was one of the people I spoke to about this group. And he kind of characterized it as, because he also works with this sort of pro-vax group. Slice of the population. So, I mean, that said, though, they're also kind of known, they drive these trucks around with these sort of anti-vaccine awards in Columbia County. And I know from people I talked to, that's been pretty unsettling for some residents.
Yeah, you broke up there. We didn't quite get that answer, the beginning of that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, now you're gone completely, sort of. Should we call back? We're trying to speak with Will Solomon right now, the author of a story in the current edition of the River Newsroom. You can go online to the River Newsroom for more information. That's a Chronogram publication online. So, Will, I'm not hearing you at all now. All right, so I'm going to call you back, and let's try this again, everybody. Sorry about this. Ooh, I don't have this. Oh, that's not. There he is. Okay. Will, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine now, so let's see how this works.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I can just sort of respond to your last question.
Yeah, we didn't hear any of that, so let's rewind back to there.
Okay, yeah, you asked about sort of how evangelical they are. I would say that they in sort of the pro-vax camp are definitely fighting over kind of a dwindling sort of slice of the population whose minds aren't made up. So, you know, on the one hand, I would say they're not, like, super aggressive. But on the other, they do, you know, one thing they're known for is driving these trucks around Columbia County that have these sort of anti-vax billboards, and that's definitely been disturbing and unsettling for many residents, including a few people I spoke to.
Have they taken any actions that would be considered threatening, or?
Well, I don't know about threatening. I mean, one of the big things they did was around when the pediatric COVID vaccine became available, and this is in the article, they sent out these little postcards to every household in Columbia County, basically, encouraging people not to vaccinate their kids against COVID. And, you know, I think that felt pretty intrusive for people. Obviously, on the scale of, like, interventions, it's you know, milder. But they're pretty active presence at, like, protests. I know Kathy Hochul recently spoke at a Columbia County Democratic fundraiser, and they had a presence there protesting. I'd say they're pretty consistent protesters, and, you know, how intrusive they are kind of depends on who you ask.
And where do you think they fall on the political spectrum? Because, I mean, this past week, Donald Trump has been, like, attacking Ron DeSantis because he won't say whether or not he got a booster shot. So where exactly do they fall on the...
Well, see, that's sort of one of the thrusts of the article. I mean, it's complicated. I think a lot of the people I spoke to would describe themselves as being more traditionally aligned with the left. So Michael Richardson, who I mentioned, he characterizes their view as kind of left libertarianism. So, you know, they tend to have some traditional left-wing views in terms of maybe like social equality and often on things like climate, although definitely not always. I characterize it as more conservative. I mean, I think the group is, and this sort of ideology up in a place like Columbia County is kind of born out of a kind of privilege up there. I think there's a lot of conservative kind of tendencies in these places that are sort of inheritors of the kind of back to the land movement. I think it's a mishmash, and I think fundamentally I kind of characterize them as more right wing because they, you know, they're kind of stringent opposition to public health measures that that are, you know, objectively saving lives, and that I think it's very difficult to square that with like a conventionally kind of left wing viewpoint.
Yeah, I think I ran into them at a pre-pandemic at a similar group at a Representative Delgado public meeting at Columbia Green Community College, which must have been in 2019. But they struck me as less left or right, but more in a demographic bucket of ex-hippies.
Yeah, I think that definitely characterizes them. I think there's sort of a cultural perception that sort of ex-hippies are, like, left-leaning, and I think that's, you know, kind of a misperception. I think especially, definitely not all these people I spoke to, but some of them definitely have money, they have property, they, you know, the kind of demographics that put you in sort of a more privileged and kind of conservative class. And I will just mention, because you mentioned that you... ran into them before the pandemic, that I think a lot of the like initial coherence before there was really a group came in response to New York repealing religious exemptions for childhood vaccinations in 2019. And so this latest sort of resistance definitely grows out of that.
Yeah, they were ready for the pandemic more than most, right?
Yeah, they were in a way, you know, and again, disturbingly so. I mean, you know, as soon as it happened, one of the people I profiled, you know, he wrote something about how COVID was like a covert operation designed to institute a eugenics campaign. Just sort of insane stuff that, was pretty much ready to go as soon as sort of the virus started spreading and the first kind of lockdown happened.
Yeah, I think they... if my memory serves, they were, when I saw them at this Delgado thing, they were also passing out 5G literature.
Yeah, that's their other, so if you go to Do We Need This website, you know, and again, this is why it can be a little hard to triangulate them ideologically. Really, the only things they take a stance on are mandatory vaccines and 5G installed without community consent. Whereas you look at a group like Stand Up Massachusetts, which is an anti-vax group in Western Mass, they definitely tend to be more in line with other sort of conservative pet causes, like, you know, not teaching critical race theory.
We should, I guess, probably say at this point in the discussion that there are very few, if any, I mean, cases of the vaccines having negative effects. I mean, I can't think of a case in the Hudson Valley of a report about someone having a bad reaction to a vaccine, this for COVID-19.
recently that they're very safe and they're very effective, and the people who are in the hospital now largely are the people who are unvaccinated. Do you want to add to any of that?
No, I think that's all correct. I mean, I think also, you know, for, you know, every demographic I've seen, statistically, the vaccine is far safer than getting COVID. And, you know, even like side effects have been reported from the vaccine, virtually all of them occur in greater numbers with COVID. So, you know, I think, I do think there are many things that need to be done, as we're seeing with like Omicron, which spreads even among your back, you know, you may be vaccinated and spread it, but you're definitely less likely to get severely ill. I think there's a broad spectrum of interventions that need to be taken to treat this seriously and protect really vulnerable people who have, you know, who have both been abandoned by groups like this, and I think to some degree by state and federal policies. And groups like this just, they don't seem that interested in, really advocating for things that would be helpful for people. They just want to see the virus spread.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what do you think their impact locally is?
You know, it's hard to say. I wasn't able to speak to anybody at the Columbia County Department of Health. I kind of heard through the grapevine that they felt like they were reaching some people. You know, I definitely think if you're nervous about the vaccine, you've got these billboards driving around saying, like, it's really bad and, you know, it's part of some, you know, nefarious campaign, they could sway you. It is hard to tell. It does seem like, for the moment, it's a bit of an echo chamber, although I wonder, and part of what I look at in the piece is whether maybe there's potential for that to change.
Yeah, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Will Solomon, who has written a story in the River Newsroom. What's the River Newsroom website?
It's theRiverNewsroom.com.
And all about this anti-vaccine group, and they are based in Columbia County, called Do We Need This?
Yeah, they definitely seem to be centered around individuals in Columbia County.
And were they behind this? There was some sort of rally that was eventually canceled in, I think, Claverack recently. Was that an anti-vaccine rally?
I'm not sure. There have been so many little things I've kind of lost track of a few.
So, but mostly they're responsible. How people would know about them is this billboard in Albany, and how else do you think?
Well, so yeah, the billboard in Albany, the billboards they drive around, like Chatham area. Definitely, if you live in Columbia County and you received one of these postcards in mid-November, encouraging you not to vaccinate your kids against COVID. If you have come across any, anti-vaccine protests in the mid-Hudson Valley or upper Hudson Valley, it's likely they've had a presence if we're not the organizers.
And do you see them as getting stronger or weakening?
Well, I guess one of the most concerning things to me is their ties to sort of more conventionally right-wing figures and the prospects of sort of a budding coalition. So for right now, I don't know that I see them getting stronger, but as I discussed in the article, they've had a number of events recently with figures with, you know, pretty disturbing links to the far right. They had an indoor event in November with Naomi Wolf, who's pretty well known, a woman named Kat McGuire, who was at the Stop the Steal rally on January 6th and, you know, wrote about storming the Capitol, has made some, you know, somewhat, you know, anti-Semitic comments, has really been big in endorsing 9/11 kind of truth stuff. And, yeah, it seems like they're possibly becoming enmeshed in sort of a broader network of kind of conspiracy theory and right-wing ideas. And I think the potential for the anti-vax movement to be bigger than that is very concerning, both locally and kind of nationally.
And I guess this week some of local right-wing politicians visited a fascist leader in Florida at Mar-a-Lago. I think Liz Joy, who's running against Paul Tonko, Elise Stefanik was there. There was a big fundraiser for New York politicians aligned with that. Is this group aligned with that group at all?
I would say no for now, but I do think that to the extent that sort of the messaging out of like the Biden administration and similar kind of, you know, like Hochul administration stays what it is, they're going to inevitably be more aligned with whatever figures are challenging them. I think there's a lot of people in the sort of do we need this orbit who would characterize themselves as having kind of ex-leftists or having left the left, and sort of downplaying the disagreements one would think they might have with more overt right-wing figures. So I definitely think there's more potential for that kind of union to develop.
Yeah, Liz Joy at least is espouses on Twitter definitely anti-vaccine views that are similar to what we're talking about here. So I could see how when come election time they would find each other useful camps.
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty accurate.
Anything else we haven't covered that you wanted to mention about the story that's in the River Newsroom currently? About this group, do we need this this anti-vaccine group in Columbia County?
Well, I guess I would just say that I think, you know, even more than the science that they espouse, which is, you know, pretty consistently incorrect, most of the people I spoke to, not necessarily all of them, but most of them associated with this group, there just seems to be a real kind of lack of empathy for people struggling with COVID. That I found the most frustrating in this, that it's less that they're trying to spread a science that they're convinced of than, I think just sort of a kind of antisocial attitude. I mean, they certainly wouldn't put it that way, but, you know, that's how I perceived it. But yeah, like I said before, I think with the spread of Omicron, with the kind of abdication of real federal involvement, we're kind of seeing that from, you know, we're seeing that from the government too. And I think that a lot of the failures of like public health policy and messaging in the pandemic have kind of strengthened these anti-vax groups, because they can point to the holes in sort of government policy and kind of use them to their advantage. So I don't know. I just think it's, you know, people should know this, but it's important to say the pandemic's still going on, that there's a lot of people who aren't, you know, well protected by vaccines. And, you know, this groups like this, their messaging is very threatening. And, you know, it's important to continue to be really diligent about protecting, you know, vulnerable people through this, because it's still going on. And, it's pretty horrible.
And did they consider themselves vulnerable people that were threatened by a media member talking to them?
I don't know, probably a little bit. I mean, you know, I think there's a sense that the kind of anti-vax perspective is just like another component of diversity. That definitely came up, that they're being unfairly singled out. And I just found that baffling, because it's like, you know, so long as you like live in a society, you have an impact. So if you're spreading this stuff, you're refusing to wear a mask in a public space, like, it's not just a, you know, it's not a characteristic of your identity. It threatens other people. So, yeah, I think a lot of people on the right tend to see themselves as victimized, and I just, you know, don't really have a lot of patience for it.
Yeah, that is why I frame the question that way, is they seem like they're, this particular victimization is a very big thing among political discussion these days. Everybody's a victim, right?
I guess so, yeah. And, you know, and I mean, you know, to some degree we all are by terrible government policies. So, you know, not go with this group and make it worse.
Yeah, and we are all a victim of a global pandemic that, you know, is beyond anyone's control, apparently.
It is, you know, and that's a big part of this too. I mean, like, this has just been kind of a big mess and failure policy and, you know, bad actions. But the conspiratorial stuff that these groups bring into it just is insane.
Well, and I think people pointed out this week, kind of accurately, the Biden administration was talking about finally sending out masks to everyone. And I think a million voices rose up on social media and said, you know, kind of, what's the point if so much of the population isn't going to bother to wear them? Why send them out? Which means, like, you know, they're kind of controlling policy if they don't end up sending out masks because a lot of people aren't going to wear them. This tiny minority is actually impacting national health policy.
Yeah, absolutely. That's sort of one of my overall takeaways, too. I mean, early in the pandemic, the kind of COVID deniers were very, you know, they just want the virus to spread. Like, it's going to become endemic, or, you know, we need herd immunity, or however, you know, however it's put in things like the Great Barrington Declaration. And to some degree, like, that logic has now been adopted by the government. I mean, now there's vaccines that are clearly mitigating the worst outcomes for many. But, you know, right now, you know, what you point to about masks or sort of the CDC shortening the quarantine window to 5 days from 10 days, there's just sort of, you know, the extent to which the economy has been prioritized over any public health measures is staggering, and it's definitely sort of symbiotic with groups like this that are on the most extreme end of just, you know, wanting the virus to spread.
And really, we may all be living in a functioning society right now because China has done these ultra shutdowns, and so much of manufacturing and creation of things is done in China. And if China was all shut down, the whole world would be all shut down now, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is interesting that China is still continuing to pursue a zero COVID policy, obviously incredibly draconian efforts, but, you know, it is pretty striking contrast from just the libertarian kind of chaos that's overtaken, you know, here.
Yeah, they're two extreme opposite ends of possible response to a pandemic. All right. Again, we've been speaking with Will Solomon, who has got an excellent story in the River Newsroom. Go there to read more about this group called Do We Need This? A Columbia County Anti-Vaccine Group. Will, it's been great to talk to you this morning.
Yeah, Tom, thank you for having me on.
All right. You are listening to the WGXC Morning Show. We will be back shortly.
Science. Well, and or a guy who controls the sea. Got killed by 10 million pounds of sludge from New York and New Jersey.
This has been the WGXC Morning Show, brought to you by... I need to write these jokes ahead of time. We're heading to a Situation Fluxus next with Cheryl Kay talking to some jazz greats. Stay tuned. Brad Munkle will be up from Greenville at noon with the Ear Candy Show. And later today on...